right. Excellent. Thank you very much. Well, a little bit of a contrast of shows to think about there. So 3 days of mopping the floor, and Louise Fishman, I don't think there is a segue there at all. There's a great deal of buzz in the painting circles I'm privileged to mix in this exhibition. It certainly gave me a great deal of pleasure, Nora. But in trying to contemplate the nature of that pleasure and trying to sort out my feelings about Fishman, something about the nature of abstract painting, unlike, say, representational painting. Is it representational painting? With abstract painting, even though we've had abstract painting since at least Kandinsky, we're well past 100 years of abstract painting, and yet it still feels we need to, when I look at an abstract painting, I need to feel, is this moving forward? One of the paintings there is called Crossing the Rubicon, and I wonder, is Fishman one of the... Is Fishman speaking to a very current spirit in abstract painting, or is she rather a living representative of some of the grand old personages that Chime and Reed exhibit? If you're not in the market for a Resnick or a Mitchell, you might want a Fishman, or if you have a Resnick and a Mitchell, you might also want a Fishman. Do you see her as a living example of a luxuriously accomplished form of lyrical, historical, abstract expressionism, or is she offering a challenge? Is she crossing a Rubicon?
Well, I think painting, more than any other art form, demands time from the viewer. It demands your time to unlock its truth content, if it has a truth content. And with Louise Fishman's work, I initially had a problem giving it that time because I was distracted by what you were just talking about, her painting language, the language of abstract expressionism. It seemed so generic and old-fashioned in her hands, and I kept sort of thinking the phrase generic romanticism kept coming back to me. Not that that's necessarily a bad thing, and I'm nostalgic for a lot of things in art and in this world, but there was something that just seemed very old to me about her work, from the titles, Violets from My Furs being a Billie Holiday song, which is actually a great title. But then I did give it more time because that's what paintings require. And I did come to find certain passages that were interesting to me where the paint began to, in a sense, act on its own. I could keep speaking about that, but maybe.
Do we want to hear about it? The paint that's when it began. It felt,
well, to me, almost like an alchemical right. experience has to occur on the level of the painting, on the level of the surface of the painting. And my problem with a lot of her work is that it sits so close to the surface. Even though there's a lot of layers on there, there's a lot of history there. I don't get a sense of a history the way I would in like a Joan Mitchell painting. It's something that is very difficult to put into words why it is different, because they might look to be quite similar. But
I almost feel if they were in bright synthetic colors and there was or something garish and unhistorical feeling, then it would just sort of sit quite happily and naturally with a lot of current painting. Is it perhaps Phoebe, the palette and the tenor? What is it that do these feel like fresh paintings to you, or do these feel like historical paintings?
I would sort of lean towards historical, although I think she's a practitioner of a genre, and I think as a practitioner of that genre, she's quite capable. And I like the fact that she is sort of going up against, you know, I mean, I think quite deliberately, the overused term of the male white patriarchy. And unlike Joan Mitchell, I think Joan Mitchell's a much better painter, and I think her work is more lyrical and emotional and poetic. But I have to say that as objects, that these are, I like the palette. I like the sort of, I mean, supposedly these are quite recent works, and many of them were done while she was on residency in Venice. And so the aquamarine tones, I find them pleasing objects to contemplate. And they're, you know, she's got a really good sense, I think, of composition and of color. And, you know, there's some impasto on the, I mean, you know, there, she's a good practitioner of an old-fashioned genre. Mm. And I would give her credit for that. I mean, is she breaking new ground? No. Is she pushing this further into the 21st or 22nd century? Probably not, you know, but it's good. It's sort of like good mediocre quality, not mediocre, right? That was a good quality work of a certain, you know, it doesn't seem to me terribly ambitious. It's not, you know, or terribly ambitious or revolutionary.
Well, it's ambitious.
Yes. It's sort of like good for you, like, you know, your vegetables or something.
Yes, it's eating your greens, except they're gray and blue. Okay, Don, are we asking the wrong questions? I mean, as somebody, as a critic, as a philosophical critic of the notion of novelty and the historical idea of the avant-garde, are we looking at these beautiful, sumptuous, accomplished paintings and asking the wrong questions and asking about their contemporaneous? How do you respond to them?
Well, I have no problem with romanticism myself. I think it's been around for a long time. I think I prefer it to a clever kitsch myself. I think the white cube was doing its job very well there in making that color, making these works stand out. She's basically sustaining a tradition. I like what Phoebe said. She's working in a genre. I don't know who doesn't work in a genre these days anyway. I think everything has its mode, and she's working in a certain mode. Now, I would agree with Phoebe in what she says in relation to Joan Mitchell, and clearly there's a pushing of a female artist there. But Joan Mitchell was a different temperament. Mm-hmm. And if you take seriously Rosenberg's idea of signature painting and signature signals of psyche, they're clearly quite different. I knew Joan fairly well. I don't want to say too much about her, but she was a very disturbed woman, and she's very dramatic, and a lot of her work has so-called that age of anxiety kind of thing.
Yes.
And this doesn't have that age of anxiety. I mean, this is a very personal kind of gestural touch, and there are different personalities, okay? And again, I remind you that Venice has, shall we say, sustained a lot of artists. You can track it way back. It's still around. It still has its color.
It's still serene, yes.
Still serene, still complex color. There's a whole history of it going back, take it back to Turner almost, Sargent and some wonderful watercolors there and so forth.
Sickert. So, don't forget Sickert.
Yes, Sickert also. I don't have any problems with this work, but I will say it's not the strongest gestralism. There was something that was called lyric expressionism. I believe MoMA had a show of it many years ago. And, you know, I'm very happy for the lyric as well as the epic, okay? I don't need de Kooning swashbuckling all the time. The tension is in some of the works. There's a certain drama. Other works, a little less tense, a little calmer, and I have no problem. I was struck by the work Old that was used, maybe because I'm, quote, old, although I hardly feel it.
You don't look it.
Oh, well, thank you. I haven't dyed my hair yet, but I, nonetheless.
Might be too late.
But my point is that there is such a thing of a seasoned art, okay? And I think there's an issue that this art raises being produced today, and it's the issue which was signaled by Mark Rosenthal at the end of his catalog essay on abstraction of the 20th century, which was for the Guggenheim, where he raised the question is, you know, what can happen with abstraction now? Its modes were there. It was formidable. The public may not be interested in it. It was too difficult. Did they get it, etc.? And I would say this moves in what I would call a kind of Baroque extravagance excess dimension without quite getting there.
Really?
Yes. Baroque? Some of the works have a kind of swirling. We put some of them on a kind of density that I would associate with certain, I would say, Italian modes of Baroque rather than German.
So Tiepolo, you see.
No, I'm not thinking of that. I'm thinking of some of the, shall we say, swagger in Bernini. Something of that sort, some of that kind of thing. I may be wrong, but some of that energy that's there. Kind of breaking out of the energy that's there. I don't think it's fully realized from that point of view, but I see it moving to somewhere else. And I think what she's also making clear is that what Kandinsky, you mentioned him as sort of the pioneer abstractionist, spoke about vibrations, you may recall. And he argued for the idiosyncrasy of art, that's his own term as well, and mood, okay? And I think these works create, evoke a certain mood. They have, for me, sufficient idiosyncrasy to suggest an individuality, a personality, although I somehow think it's not a completely fulfilled personality.
Okay.
Or at least not dense enough.
Thanks. Thanks.
Okay, good.
Good.
Anyways, I like the stuff.
We like getting pleasure
from color.
We're getting pleasure from it.
Looks finished. They look, I mean, to me, they do look complete. I don't think she's pushed the genre further.
That's what I mean.
But she's an excellent practitioner of it. You
can't
go in there and not think.
Is it like hearing traditional jazz? It's like hearing somebody who's not making a weird noise that throws us out of our seat. Is producing some beautiful jazz, but then you say, okay, it's beautiful jazz, but Charlie Parker did that. And then you can come back and say, well, that's the wrong question. A beautiful jazz is beautiful jazz, period. Don't confuse the issue by bringing in Charlie Parker. So is it confusing the issue to bring in Franz Klein or...
Because those are the obvious references, and because you can't really take her out of the context of art history.
Yes.
I mean, there were people that were antecedent to her that, if she's not, that she's certainly familiar with, even if she's not referencing them specifically.
One could almost say, actually, though, when we look at somebody who's very hip and young and doing something abrasive and quote-unquote new, it's referencing something from a year,
well,
2 years, or 3 years ago.
She's not Cecily Brown, okay? She's not trying to do what Cecily Brown does.
Let's keep the scale.
But she's a contemporary young abstract artist. You could argue, even though her work is more narrative and it has more figuration in it, it's still in the tradition of abstract expressionism. But if you look at it, it's she's trying to push the envelope, whereas I think Louise Fishman deeply feels these paintings and produces them, and they feel truthful. They feel like she's executed what she meant to execute, and she has the tools to do it, which is rare enough.
She knows her medium.
Yeah, and that's rare enough in any gallery that you walk into in Chelsea. I mean, it's almost startling, which is maybe why you think it's old-fashioned.
And I love things that are not abrasive in this city.
Yeah. It's just wonderful to walk in somewhere, and I'm not a big fan of abstract expressionism at all, and yet you walk in there and you think, okay, on the terms of what she's trying to do with these paintings, these are beautiful, accomplished paintings.
Yeah.
I think she has an ambivalent relationship with beauty. I feel like the paintings, I had trouble locating the body. When I look at abstract painting, I make abstract paintings as well. The body, not in the sense of like a de Kooning, like Woman One or something, but the body of the artist and the body of the viewer looking at the painting. And with her work, one of my problems is that I didn't feel the body present. In some of them, they're more than others.
Why do you need the body anyway?
Yeah, I don't know. I would never look for the body in that.
Not actually like a physical body. It's more of a sensation.
Yeah, I don't,
really.
She doesn't mean a. She does not mean a representation.
I do not
body.
Mean a representational
she
body.
The body that's
I mean, because we talk a lot about feeling and authentic feeling, and I think it's. With her work, she seems to be saying, I'm having an authentic feeling. These are my feelings. I was in Venice. And for me, it's almost like someone's hitting over the head with that. And let's compare her to, I mean, people who are her peers, Mary Heilman, Cora Cohen. I mean, I think it's more productive to do that than to talk about someone like Frantz Klein.
That's true. She belongs to a generation. Remember, she was in the show Upstairs, a very memorable show, the High Times, Hard Times show. So really, her peer group would include
Ron Gorchov.
Well, yes, as an older member, but certainly would include Joan Snyder and David Yao and quite a number of the artists in the conceptual abstraction show at the moment at Hunter College, and a number of other. Historic figures, not historic. She has a peer group, and it seems to me that her work is a lot more trad than most of those peers. And the other thing is though that when I look at, I thought this is one of her best shows, and I got pleasure from it. I love the fact that it has that Venetian mist quality to it. I'm a sort of Venice nut and can never get enough of it in a way, especially if it's the kind of Sickert Turner version of Venice. But it seemed odd, though, that somebody who's as concerned in these paintings with atmosphere rather than with, I agree with Nora, rather than the body making the gestures, it's odd that the brush is such a strong element in compositional and structural element in all these paintings. Why does she not? Why? What is she saying to us in the almost ubiquity of the brush stroke? I can see in my mind's eye the brushes she must be using. They're thick and they're wide, and they are that stripe and lozenge. I want to say that doesn't give me mist and the sea. So why the brush? Anybody want to make a spirited defense of the brush in these Fishmeads?
There's some density in some of the works, and certainly that is related to, quote, Venice in some way also. It's not exactly evaporating all the time, that's it. But she may be signaling, in some way referring back to the early expressionistic handling.
She's using that she's using an older language
exactly.
Deliberately, I think.
Which makes one wonder if she's in some sense quoting, in some sense.
Yeah,
I didn't entirely clear.
Uh-huh. You see, my fear is that the brush is to Fishman what the grid is to Stuart. It's just a received given that isn't really being thought through as in its use.
I would agree with that.
All right. Okay. Well, when I get distinguished people saying I agree with that, it goes straight to my head. And before we have time to disagree, let's move to our last show. Well, it's election season. And there's one vote for sale in Ohio. Not for sale. Sale's the wrong point. But this man with conflicted loyalties, he tells us. On the one hand, he voted for Barack Obama in the last time. He had an opportunity to do so. He's an artist. Therefore, he has to be a liberal, right? But at the same time, the gentleman, Casey Jack Smith, is... a devout Mormon, and this has arisen, therefore, of the conflict that many people have for some reason in America. Do I vote with my brain and do what's best for the whole nation, or do I act on a tribal instinct? It's odd that people should give public, should actually publicize that this is a dilemma for them, but it seems that you have cases where, people who would naturally support one cause come out and say, but I've got to vote for the woman, or I've got to vote for the African-American, or whatever, who's on the other side of the cause. And it seems to be this is possibly the case also with Mormonism. Now, throw into the mix that this person is not only a devout Mormon, but he is also a very enthusiastic player of Dungeons and Dragons, and then we get one very complicated and complex exhibition in which a game is also being played out for his vote, because he's split between doing what he thinks is best for the country and supporting a co-religionist. This vote apparently can be swayed one way or the other in a complex game that involves looking at some very dense imagery at the Allegra La Viola Gallery, and we could possibly get one more swing vote in Ohio. Well, okay. Phoebe. Are you still digesting this imagery? Are you blown away by this show?
I think that your description gives it, the show, so much more credit than I would give it. I think it's a clever premise. I will go with the press release that says he's a devout Mormon. I mean, certainly he's an obsessive compulsive, based on the sort of, intricacy of these teeny little obsessive drawings. The show did nothing for me. I wasn't there the night of the opening when I guess they actually had two competitors playing out the Dungeons and Dragons game, of which I also know nothing. But, I mean, I was impressed that the guy put so much work into it and that he was operating in a number of different media. He has little sculptures, he has drawings, he has paintings, he has a video game. I mean, he covers all the bases. But it actually didn't cohere for me at all. I didn't get it at all, and I didn't find it really very interesting, despite the, as the sort of convergence of elements that you're describing that really should have made it interesting, it was meaningless to me.
Right.
I mean, I might as well have, it was just like, snow on a TV set to me.
Yes. May have been even a bit like being thrown into a convention of Dungeons and Dragons enthusiasts and, like Phoebe and myself, not knowing anything about or perhaps even wanting to know anything about this game, this very much this Anorak-type game. Phoebe, I'm sorry, you're Phoebe. Yeah, Nora. Whatever else is or isn't going on in this show and whatever it means and whatever we're to make of it, the languages deployed, the hand, the script, the deep symbolism, or perhaps the not so deep symbolism, does put one in mind of all kinds of contemporary artists, many of whom congregate at the Pierogi Gallery, for instance, in Brooklyn. I almost think of this as being somebody with totally different worldview and taste and style, but somehow, nonetheless, one weird thing in common with the late Mark Lombardi. Is this a sort of Mark Lombardi with bad taste? I mean, what would you say?
Oh, I mean, he's a very skilled illustrator. I was sort of reminded of Zap Comics, mm-hmm. Almost like a less imaginative R. Crumb. Mm-hmm. But I agree with Phoebe. I just found the work pretty disturbing in its cynicism. And completely devoid of imagination, completely cut off from social reality, and especially in this election, which is so critically important for our country, for the world, the fact that this artist would put so much effort into creating a show and then making the gesture of giving away his vote to whoever won this Dungeons and Dragons game. I didn't see it. Just found that gesture incredibly negative.
It seems to me almost sort of Harold Bloom has said that the Church of Latter-day Saints is the closest that America has come to an authentic Gnosticism, and then to hear somebody who, as well as being a devout Mormon, is also a player of a game that is incredibly complex and arcane and Arthurian and Tolkien in its symbolism, to hear that somebody who's got a religion that's already highly symbolist and brings another game of symbolism to it, to hear Nora say that he lacks imagination, that's Put the two together, that's quite a contrasting setup. What do you think? Do you feel that there's a kind of charge of something Gnostic in Smith's use of symbolism?
No, I don't. But let me say I agree with both Nora and Phoebe, but I would just throw in a few other ideas. I first agree that he's an illustrator, and he's a decent illustrator. I don't know how great it is, but he's an illustrator. I also think he's trying to be topical in more ways than one. It's not just this election, which is coming up, which I do think is important for the United States, maybe for the world, although I think the new Chinese Politburo will be more important for the world than the American election, but that's my own opinion. But anyway, it would have been nice if he had something about China in that. It was a sort of hodgepodge exhibition. He was showing that he could do different things. He understood color. Games are trendy. I wonder if he was, I somehow got a sense that he's obsessive compulsive, and what came to mind was the fact that in the 2013 Diagnostic Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Society, there will be the first time a listing of internet addiction. Okay,
right.
So I wonder if in some sense he's signaling various addictions, not only dragons and whatever, but art to art, addiction to art, and he's got some nice colorful pieces, some very nice color there, you know, very charming. So this guy is addictive. Now, about the Mormons, it's extremely interesting, it sort of raises some crazy thoughts in my mind. The Mormons, remember, can baptize people who are already dead. There was a big controversy a few years ago when they baptized the family of some prominent Jews, and they apologized for doing that. Also, I understand that a very good Mormon gets a planet of his or her own in the future, and somewhere, I'm telling you the truth.
One guy might get one of his own right on November the 6th.
November 6th. And of course, Romney was a bishop, I remind you. He was a bishop. And if you've read something about his biography, he was, when he was born, his family sort of regarded him as the promised son, really. So I think that our artist is profoundly confused about his identity. I think that he is trying to be, in some sense, hip-hop, or whatever you call it these days, and not quite sure what he's hipping or hopping on, or what the ground is underneath him. So it's very interesting as a cultural or social phenomena. It's a sort of hot pseudo-outsider art, something like that.
Yeah, there's a little bit of the I'm a Mormon, therefore I'm an outsider feel to this.
Yeah.
I you know, just to finish up on politics, which is worse to have in the White House, a bishop or a pawn? But that said,
I just wanted to say that there's two. To me, there was something troublingly cultish.
Yeah.
There's a feeling
that he
was programmed. Like I'm not confusing the Mormon religion with Scientology, but I got the combination of the devout religion and the symbology of that and the addiction to the Dungeons and Dragons and using that as a template through which to see the election. I almost felt like he was a member of a cult. And then on top of that, he's sort of sampling the elements of these, like, you know, the hip-hop that Donald brought up. I mean, he has, like, ADD, you know. It's a very, I mean, Donald, I think what Donald didn't finish saying maybe is that it's a very good, of all the shows, it might be the most psychoanalytic statement about the artist who made it. You get more of who this artist is, or who he isn't, or who he thinks he is, or who he doesn't know he is, than from any of the other shows.
But surely
it's the least successful
But it
show.
May be a symbol also of the larger confusion and fragmentation of the art world.
And he does a sampling thing, too, that DJs do.
Yeah, sampling is a good word.
He's like sampling across the media and across different imagery, but I still couldn't get away from this sort of robot cult feeling, like he'd been programmed and like he was just spitting out this imagery that he'd been brainwashed with.
But surely he's so self-conscious and so he's there's a I'm not in love with this show, obviously, but I would say that it's patently obvious the guy's got a sense of humour. I mean, he's got a sense of distance from himself as well. I mean, yeah, okay, obsessive compulsive, of course, but that does count from, you know, 2/3 of the artists in Brooklyn. You've got somebody here. When somebody is parading the Mormon articles of faith, showing us the most weird and obscure details of the symbolism of that faith, but without really giving you the positive gel that makes that symbolism meaningful to the practitioner, and then on top of it laying on what's another super nerdish complex system of Dungeons and Dragons. I mean, one or the other of those two systems of symbolism would be Masonic enough in its bewildering complexity, but putting both together, it seems to be a very self-conscious state, almost narcissistic parade of nerdishness. You say, you know, come look at me and my anorak, it seems to be sort of saying. Don't you think that there's a self-conscious nerdishness? Just picking up on what one of my co-panelists said, a sort of willful pseudo-outsider quality to the work?
Well, definitely, and I think also the way the work is installed, too, it's not... I think a few pieces are frames, but a lot of the drawings are just tacked to the wall with push pins. Mm-hmm. And these are very meticulously... These drawings took hours, days. You know, mm-hmm. they're not casual drawings by any means, but the casualness that... how they're attached to the wall, mm-hmm. I found that disturbing, too. It brought to mind, in like being in high school and doodling in a notebook, and that kind of mindset where you're not totally focused, but you're obsessively doing something else. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, like the adolescent kind of adolescent quality that permeated everything.
Yeah, adolescent. Like it was sort of like welcome to my clubhouse, and we're about to do the hazing, and once you have the hazing, you'll get all this stuff, which you're not going to get. Because it doesn't communicate otherwise.
That's the problem, I think, with this show. I got nothing against three layers of arcane symbolism if they add up to the magic flute. But it seems the art might have been... It seems that art is what's missing in this art exhibition, to be honest. But let's see if our audience wishes to challenge us first on our misreading of the radical, innovatory nature of Louise Fishman, and second, on our disgraceful inability to see both the art and the meaning in Casey Jack Smith. Don't worry about it, whichever you want to say first. Let's get going. Let's just have some comments. And comments are better than questions at this stage.
One word that I think... I sort of see actually all four of the artists now in like a good arc, beginning with Alan Kaprow bringing up the question of what is art and what are we doing with it, and then ending with this like usage of art as pure escapism. And it seemed like that was the word that was coming up with all of those comments, and the sort of disturbing usage of art as pure escapism from the world. Excuse me. And then Louise Fishman, for example, as this sort of late expressionist trying to like this brush idea, like almost a desperation to hold on to like using your medium rather than Michelle, who I think like many of us trying to make work today feel is pressure to make a comment on your medium or your genre. So the kind of the frame is such a heavy burden now. Like there, I think at the end of the day, we all sort of want to just heave that off, but yet there's a responsibility now or something. There's a heavy question of, and by very smart people like Alan Kaprow, just being like, let's question this. What are we doing this with this? And why is this meaning sort of already sometimes on the work or something? So
yeah,
that, it was actually a very interesting for...
Great. Thanks very much for tying all four together. That's a thought-provoking move. Thanks for that. Any other comments on the last two shows we've seen, the Smith and the Fishman? Yes, sir.
On the Smith, my first reaction to it was very negative. I thought it was just much too complex and weird, and I also felt it was sort of pseudo outsider. But I wonder if we're maybe doing him a bit of an injustice just because he's a trained artist and a decent illustrator. I mean, maybe he's really exploring his own very weird hang-ups with Mormonism. And when I keep thinking of that picture of Romney looking like Joseph Smith or with a beard, and then Obama looking like some kind of evil wizard, it just struck me as maybe that's what's going through his head. Maybe
yes.
That's why he's afraid to vote for Obama and thinks he has to vote for Romney.
Well, there must be some log cabins in Ohio filled with such minds, and it may be that the future of civilization depends on what their mood is on November the 6th. But, anyone feel they want to respond to?
Well, the question is how many wives Smith has, yes? If he wants to identify with the original Smith, okay? But I think the art is dressed to a certain peer group, myself. And that is the cult aspect. And, you know, you go along with it or you don't go along with it. And I also think he's confused between what used to be called anti-art and what art is. I mean, he's trying to touch every base, as it were, can do this and that. And I frankly got a sense it was sort of kind of art school art, if I may say so. Nothing wrong with art schools, a place where you educate yourself to do hopefully every possible thing rather than get bogged down in one style, as unfortunately happens.
There's nothing wrong with kindergarten, except when you're 45.
That's
yes.
Right, yes. Mm. I also somehow felt that he wasn't serious about Mormonism. I'm not sure that he knows what it is about, apart from some of the symbols. I don't think he's aware of its development and its respectability that it's had for a while. It's become, I think it was Bloom, in fact, who said it, it's no longer a religion, it's a movement. And he compared, it's a people, rather, and he compared
right.
it to the Jews.
Right,
he
exactly.
said that. And the Mormons have thought of themselves as the lost tribe of Jews. That's part of what's there. So that would make it also more peer groupish or in-groupish or whatever you want to call it. If I may just say so, I like the tying together of all of these works. And if I may be so bold and negative to say so, there was something about them all as a group that was flat, stale, and unprofitable. Okay.
Right, right.
As a group, you know, certain choices were made. They're interesting. It reminded me of Hegel's remark that after Romanticism, which he thought would be the last great movement, symbolism, classicism, Romanticism, all art, he said famously, would be interesting. Okay. Mm. Now, he didn't live to the present time to see just how interesting it was, it would become. But he thought actually Christian art was the romantic art. He said that explicitly in his lecture. So maybe you could throw in some nature there. So, you know, the question is maybe this that is implicated in all of what we're saying or what I'm trying to say. It used to be, and going to Hegel, that art had, quote, a big idea. You know, it was about a big idea. And I don't quite see a big idea in any of this art. Now, maybe art doesn't need a big idea anymore.
Right.
You know, maybe it doesn't have to serve a big idea. You know, most art in the past is connected to the religion of the state. Whether you like the religion of the state or not is another question, you know.
Right.
But it was informed by this. You know, you may not like Christianity, but Grunewald is extraordinary, okay?
Right.
As art. And without Christianity, where would Grunewald be? It's not entirely clear. That, I think, is one of the issues that art has faced since the beginning of modernism. In fact, I think after symbolism, myself, where the big idea was the unconscious, explicitly stated by Redon in Dream Portfolio. And it's not clear that that's around now. So you have all kinds of different sources for art.
Maybe internet addiction will be the new Christian art for the...
I'm sorry?
Maybe internet addiction will
internet
be the
addiction?
New equivalent of Christian art and romanticism for...
it's not exactly transcendent internet addiction.
It's not...
It doesn't transfigure you.
Well, let's see. Maybe the next Grunewald will be transfigured by his internet addiction, if not by his Mormon faith, his love of Venice and brushstrokes, his obsession with photographs of the past and grids, or with building tree houses on Columbus Circle. So let's ponder these philosophical conundra and enjoy the rest of the evening. Goodbye. well...